Hi, it's Mountain Edition, all the news from the week here in the Roaring Fork Valley coming at you in the next half hour. I'm Kristen Kay, and I'm here with Claire Woodcock for our first show of 2018. Happy New Year, Claire.
Happy New Year, Kristen.
And there's already lots of news this year. Eagle County, with the help of Colorado State University, is changing the way it helps abused children. Also, we'll take a winter hike up Red Hill in Carbondale, where the Aspen Valley Land Trust is looking to improve safety for hikers and bikers.
We'll also hear how hotels down valley are impacted by snow levels at the Up Valley resorts. And fracking and public safety may make an appearance on ballots in the 2018 midterm election.
The biggest stories from this week coming up on Mountain Edition. Congressman Jared Polis is hoping to become Colorado's next governor. He'll be in Aspen on Saturday at an event hosted by Pitkin County Democrats.
Wyatt Orm has more.
Congressman Polis represents the 2nd District, which is made up of 10 counties, including Boulder and Summit counties. He was elected to the position in 2008. He's one of 9 Democratic candidates vying to become their party's gubernatorial candidate in November's election. Both Republicans and Democrats will caucus for their candidates in early March. To caucus either as a Democrat or a Republican, you need to be registered with the parties by Monday, January 8th. Wyatt Orm, Aspen Public Radio News.
A Colorado grassroots organization is working to get a fracking question on the 2018 ballot.
Elizabeth Stewart Severy reports.
The group Colorado Rising submitted a ballot measure last week that would establish a 2,500-foot buffer between oil and gas development and any occupied structures like homes and schools. It also identifies open spaces, playgrounds, and sports fields as vulnerable areas that would be subject to the same setback requirement. The proposal would increase the current setbacks by as much as 2,000 feet. After the ballot language is accepted by the state, Colorado Rising would need about 100,000 signatures on a petition to get the measure in front of voters. A similar question in 2016 didn't get enough signatures to make it on the ballot. Elizabeth Stewart Severy, Aspen Public Radio Environment Desk.
So I think we have a pretty interesting history of names here in the Roaring Fork Valley. I think it's really cool that Glenwood Springs used to be called Defiance until I think an elected official's wife moved here and thought that that didn't sound very proper, so it was changed to Glenwood Springs.
Oh, wow. And now that you mention it, the Colorado River, which runs through the Glenwood, hasn't always had its current name either.
Until 1921, the river's upper reaches were known as the Grand River, which is how Grand Junction and Grand County got their names.
As KUNC's Luke Runyon reports, changing the name of the river was a personal crusade for a legendary West Slope congressman.
As a boy, Joseph Taylor III and his family would pile into a station wagon for long summer road trips. They visited some pretty desolate stretches of the Mountain West, and during one trip, he remembers the car rumbling across cattle grates.
Out onto BLM land, followed by my mother waving her arms and saying, "Your great-grandfather created all this."
Taylor and his brothers would groan from the back seat. They'd already heard all the stories of their great-grandfather, turn-of-the-century Democratic Colorado Congressman Edward Taylor. It wasn't until Joseph Taylor got into Western history in college that he had to reckon with the fact that
one of my relatives showed up in every single historical study of the American West, and especially all the textbooks.
Taylor is now a professor of American history at Simon Fraser University in British Columbia, Canada. While his great-grandfather is probably best known for his grazing legislation, he was also a champion of West Slope water.
His priority is development, but first and foremost, the West Slope, second, Colorado, and third, the West.
Before 1921, the Colorado River actually started in Utah, in the present-day Canyonlands National Park. That's where Wyoming's Green River and the Grand River, which started in Colorado's Rocky Mountain National Park, met.
It seems to have rankled a fair number of people on the West Slope of Colorado, where the Colorado River headwaters were, that they had a name that really didn't resonate with the state.
And so he took on the river's renaming as a personal crusade in Washington, D.C.
He was known from time to time to get up on the floor and make glowing 5 to 10 minute speeches about his adored state.
And his speech to rename the Grand River as the Colorado fits in that same mold. The Library of Congress still has a copy of it on file, and from start to finish, it's an over-the-top pitch to his fellow lawmakers. I had Joseph Taylor read one of the best passages about the river and the Grand Canyon.
It is a weird, fascinating, moving, imperial tragedy of nature. It certainly is the waterway of the gods, and that canyon is the Titan of chasms, incomparably the greatest abyss on Earth.
I think the technical phrase for that form of rhetoric is pulling out the stops.
Patty Limerick is the Colorado State historian based at the Center for the American West in Boulder.
When Edward Taylor talks about the appeal of the Colorado River to Americans and why Americans should go see it, it's not just saying, well, it's kind of pretty. It's really on the borders of civic religion.
But to fully appreciate the efforts of Edward Taylor, you have to know what was going on in Colorado at that time. The western half of the state was stuck in a series of boom and bust cycles. Mines were struggling, and so were farms. In this resource-heavy economy, some started wondering if Colorado's natural wonders might be better suited left in place for tourists.
That recognition that there might be a whole other form of prosperity that comes from people coming to look at things in a state that is really quite a show-off state when it comes to landscape.
And so that's part of what Edward Taylor brought with him to Congress. At the time, he was the West Slope's biggest booster. As he wrapped up his final remarks to get the Grand River renamed the Colorado, he drew on pop culture of the 1920s to help drive his point home. Again, here's his great-grandson, Joseph E. Taylor III, reading his words.
There is a very popular, beautiful, and famous song, which I hope you will have heard, entitled Where the Silvery Colorado Wends Its Way. And I hope you gentlemen will help me wend the Silvery Colorado's way into the grand state that bears its name.
For the sunlight plays no more from my cheerless cabin door. Where the Silvery Colorado wends its way.
I'm Luke Runyon.
This story was produced in partnership with public media station KUNC in Northern Colorado, with financial support by the Walton Family Foundation.
The city of Aspen was early to act to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, but has fallen far short of targets.
Environment reporter Elizabeth Stewart Savory looked into why that is and what the city plans to do about it.
The city of Aspen first adopted a climate action plan in 2007 with a target of an 80% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions by 2050. City staff has promoted energy efficiency, increased mass transit, supported a bike share program, and more. These actions have reduced emissions, but Aspen's population kept growing, and those reductions have been somewhat lackluster. Chris Mengus is with the city's Climate Action Department.
Even with a ton of action, 10 years of really driven action in Aspen, with our growth, it only reduced emissions 7%.
That's only a fraction of the ultimate goal. So Mengus and his coworkers have developed a new plan, a bigger plan, with 48 action items to start really tightening the belt on emissions. Laura Armstrong says one approach is to work collaboratively with other governments, businesses, and utilities in the region.
For these actions really to be realized, it's going to take all of us working together.
What kind of expectations do you guys have?
So the really cool thing about this climate action plan is we were able to look at really specific strategies and actions and model out if we did these items, where would that get us? And what we found is that by 2050, we can get emissions down to 71% below 2004 levels.
So that's a promising finding because that's 71% with what we know right now. Mm-hmm. So that's the technologies, business models, and practices that are available today. All we know for sure about the future is that we don't know everything that's coming, but we do anticipate new technologies, practices, and business models will be available over the next 30 some years. So if we see that we could get to minus 71% today, we think that over the time between now and 2050, we'll be able to bend that down even more, and that 80% actually is achievable.
What will people see? or smell.
So hopefully they'll smell less exhaust. Hopefully what this really looks like is less traffic and congestion, more people on bikes, or more options to get from park and rides into town in ways that are really convenient for people. I think it also looks like spending less on your energy because you're using it really efficiently. It looks like, you know, we're sending less organic waste to the landfill. So we're not filling it up as fast. We're saving money for taxpayers. And we're also reducing our emissions because we're composting more and we're getting the organic components out of construction and demolition waste.
Okay, thanks for being here. That's Chris Mengus and Laura Armstrong with the City of Aspen's Climate Action Department.
You're listening to Mountain Edition from Aspen Public Radio News. I'm Claire Woodcock.
And I'm Kristen Kay. And Claire, obviously, if people are listening to Mountain Edition, they want to stay informed about local news.
Totally. One of the ways they can do that is by visiting Aspen Public Radio's Facebook page. While you're there, don't hesitate to like it.
There you can interact with our station through comments on our posts and by messaging us directly.
Yeah, and this week you can see First Draft with Mitzi Rapkin. She spoke with fiction writer Alice McDermott, who's written books like The Ninth Hour and will be kicking off the winter word season from Aspen Words next week.
Check it out by searching Aspen Public Radio on Facebook.
Eagle is one of seven counties in Colorado getting federal money to learn about trauma and abused children.
As Wyatt Orm reports, the grant will allow the county to continue work it's already doing.
Since 2013, Eagle County has made a point of teaching mental health providers in the county's own child welfare department how to identify trauma in abused children. Kendra Kleinschmidt is a deputy director at the county's Department of Human Services. She says screening for trauma is a matter of asking the right question.
Instead of thinking, gosh, what's wrong with this child? A trauma-informed way to think about that would be, gosh, what's happened to this child?
Yesterday, the Eagle County Board of Commissioners signed an agreement with Larimer County and Colorado State University. Experts from CSU are now in charge of teaching any mental health provider in Eagle County how to screen for trauma. The goal is to cut down on the number of kids going to residential treatment centers or to group homes. Wyatt Orm, Aspen Public Radio News.
As one of their last moves of 2017, Aspen City Council voted 3-2 to approve an affordable housing unit on Castle Creek Road. The two dissenters, Mayor Steve Skadron and Ward Howenstein, were frustrated that the development would be shorter than originally proposed, thus providing less housing. Reporter Allison Bektesh spoke with the three remaining members who did vote to approve the smaller building, and she joins me now. Hi, Allison.
Hi, Kristen.
So housing has been a big community-wide discussion all fall. How did this decision play into all of that?
Well, I would say this fall's controversy really comes down to a discussion of housing stock. It was framed in this kind of generational conflict, but really what we're saying is that there is a shortfall for those people who live and work in Pickens County. So we have this new development making its way through the planning stages with final approval up to city council. And I think for all of those we were hearing from all fall that said we need more housing, it did feel a little out of tone that they approved the smaller building and allowing for less housing.
So what would this project have done for housing stock?
What ultimately got approved was three stories that will have a number of different size rental units. The difference was that what was offered was a four-story building. And because this building is being built into a slope, the view would have only looked about 3 feet difference from a three-story building to a four-story building. Yet there were people who live in that neighborhood who were complaining that four stories is just too tall. And Bert Myron said that he voted against the fourth story because he was afraid that lawsuits would come out of this, thus holding up something we do need, this new affordable housing building. Ann Mullins and Adam Frisch voted strictly against the density and the height. We don't allow four-story buildings in Aspen. Why would the city all of a sudden get to be allowed that? That's just not the character of our community. So though we could have built to four stories, they said that capacity doesn't fit with the character.
So what does the council see as their role within this housing discussion?
Adam Frisch has been working on housing for nearly a decade, both on and off the council, and I think it really hit him in his core when he saw the divisiveness that came out of this within the community. He and Bert have both said sometime in the next few weeks, City Council should have a work session where they draft a resolution assuring the community that you will never be kicked out of your house based on retirement, that is not something the City Council supports, and they want something as hearty as a resolution to let people know that. Anne wasn't so sure that a resolution like that could pass on this council, but she does say the city council needs to take a direct role, not just in building housing, but also everything that goes with that.
What I see we're dealing with is Aspen's kind of hollowing out. All groups are, I think, in agreement. Bottom line is providing affordable housing. But I'm pushing it further that we've got to provide the amenities that go with that housing to make it a stronger community.
So coming up this month, there'll be a discussion on a potential resolution. Also in the wings is a discussion about APTRA governance as a whole.
Okay, thanks for your time, Allison.
My pleasure.
The Aspen Valley Land Trust recently purchased 25 acres at the base of the Red Hill Recreation Area.
The organization is partnering with the town of Carbondale to improve safety for hikers and bikers, if they can raise the funds. Elizabeth Stewart-Severy has more.
Red Hill is popular, to say the least, especially in a dry winter when people are still hiking and biking instead of skiing.
This place has been packed. You'll see trail users spread out across the entire road on both sides, dogs and kids and bikes and everything in between, and it's really become a problem.
Suzanne Stevens is executive director of AVLT, the Aspen Valley Land Trust. She's standing near the parking area for Red Hill, where hikers leave their cars and then walk about a half a mile up a county road to the trailhead. The 25 acres between Highway 82 and the current trailhead was privately owned and zoned for commercial development. That's the land that AVLT purchased in December. Jay Harrington is Carbondale's town manager.
We consider Red Hill as our front door to Carbondale.
Much of the stretch of Highway 82 between Carbondale and Glenwood Springs has a light industrial feel, and Harrington was concerned that would spread to this intersection. He says the town heard from mini storage and construction staging companies who were interested in buying the land.
We see it as a major recreation area for our residents and with the entire valley.
And because of that, Harrington and others argue that there's a long-term benefit, not just to prevent development, but also to make the area safer. Right now, hikers and bikers park at what was originally intended as a park and ride lot, which Stephen says is a mess that will have to be worked out with CDOT in the future.
On a busy day, there's absolutely no place to park, and cars are scattered everywhere.
And then those looking for some time in nature have to contend with cars on a county road for about a half a mile before connecting to the trail system. Ken Riley is a blacksmith in Carbondale. He lives up the county road near Red Hill, and he drives that road just about every day to work or taking his kids to school and activities.
I see crazy things. I see people spread out across the road and, of course, dogs that are darting here and there. And there's two blind corners going through that very short section.
The speed limit is 20 miles per hour, but Riley says it's best to slow way below that to practically crawl through the area.
It's much better to wave and smile at everybody than try to, you know, buzz through them.
AVLT and the town of Carbondale hope to eliminate the issue altogether. The plan is to build a single-track trail that gets hikers and bikers off the road to the trailhead. But Stevens explains that part is not a done deal.
What we're still working on now is to really turn it into a community asset and be able to put in those trails. And that won't happen unless we can still raise some more funds by January 15th.
Stevens says the entire project will cost $1.35 million. That includes buying the land, building new trails, and establishing an endowment for the town of Carbondale to be able to manage and maintain the trails in years to come. They're over two-thirds of the way to the goal, with help from local governments, a real estate transfer fee from River Valley Ranch, and individual donors. Like Carbondale trustee Ben Baumfock, who donated his $900 trustee stipend to the cause. It's close to his heart, a place where he finds time for reflection.
I go up there quite a bit. I actually just really love the perspective that it gives you on Carbondale and in the valley and Mount Sopris and all that. When you get up there, I end up kind of looking down and, you know, you can really just see everything from up there. I really love that.
The rally cry for the project is Save Red Hill, which might not be totally accurate. The actual trail system at Red Hill is not threatened.
Yeah, the core part of Red Hill is safe, but it's not safe for people to be walking up that road all the time. And it's a disaster of a parking situation at the bottom of the hill, and it truly could become something like mini storage if it was in private development. So I think it's a really important thing to preserve for future generations, so that it's not just preserved, but that it's actually improved.
It's a true question of access to public lands, he says. Red Hill is a piece of property that everyone in Carbondale uses, but the town doesn't have the funds to buy. AVLT's deadline is January 15th. That will keep them on track to have the new trails open in the fall. Elizabeth Stewart-Severy, Aspen Public Radio Environment Desk.
This is Mountain Edition on Aspen Public Radio. I'm Claire Woodcock.
And I'm Kristen Kay. In other Aspen Public Radio news, the Republican Senate president has some ideas about what he'd like to see happen during the next legislative session.
The town of Basalt is raising water rates starting this month. Consumers can expect bills to be 45% higher.
Aspen's Key & Company had to cancel the full moon dinner that was scheduled earlier this week as safety concerns are growing on area mountains.
And we talked to Grammy-nominated electronic music duo Odessa, who stopped by the Belly Up last week.
Those stories and more news are on our website now. Take a listen at aspenpublicradio.org. Carbondale Arts' 10th annual Green is the New Black fashion extravaganza is coming up, and the nonprofit is looking for models.
Dancers, designers, and artists will come together to celebrate a decade of productions that are both entertaining and sustainable. The theme of this year's show is supernatural and will explore forces like astronomy and dreams. Carbondale Arts Fashion Show Committee is looking for about 45 models. Community members ages 18 to roughly 80 are encouraged to audition. This year's fashion show takes place March 9th and 10th. Auditions are Sunday, January 7th at 6 in the launch pad.
January 7th, so still plenty of time for people to work on their model strut, right?
3 days, people.
Another story that might involve people strutting their stuff, politically, that is. 3 seats on Basalt's town council are up for grabs in April.
Prospective candidates can sign up to run starting this week. Wyatt Orm has more.
Nomination petitions for interested candidates are now available from the town clerk. They need to be returned by January 22nd with at least 25 signatures from registered Basalt voters. Council members Bernie Grauer, Mark Kittle, and Gary Tenenbaum are at the end of their terms. Each can choose to run again, however, for another 4 years on the council. Candidates also need to be eligible Basalt voters and need to have lived there for at least a year prior to April 3rd, which is Election Day. Wyatt Orm, Aspen Public Radio News.
At least some snow and the holidays have helped hotels fill up in Aspen and snowmass, but in December, hotels had reason to be worried. Zero snow was in the forecast, and people were canceling their vacation plans to come here. Our reporter, Wyatt Orm, wanted to know, when the snow is thin, what effect is there on hotels down valley? He joins me in the studio now to discuss. So, Wyatt, does a lack of snow affect hotels down valley?
It does. But I think that the further from the resorts you get, the less dependent, it seems, hotels are on skiers. There, of course, aren't too many hotels in the Mid-Valley, but I called a few. I spoke with the Basalt Mountain Inn, and they told me that they were getting somewhere in the neighborhood of 10 calls a day earlier in the month, with people calling to either cancel or move their reservations. Skiers staying in Basalt is typically families, mostly from the Front Range and from Texas, and they're looking for something a little more affordable than what Aspen has to offer. Getting 10 calls a day is not the norm. The guy that I spoke to at the Basalt Mountain Inn said it's usually families calling to fight to get a room, not to get rid of the room. I also called the Element Hotel. It's also in Basalt. They said something similar. Lack of snow has certainly affected businesses, but like in Aspen, their holiday numbers are strong. The woman at the Element who I spoke with said that probably 5% of guests were canceling because of the snow conditions. Winter is very busy for hotels in Basalt, but it's not the busiest season. Summer is actually the busiest season, and that's when people are coming to bike and to fish.
So what does it look like in the Glenwood area?
So all the official numbers will be published in January. That's when we'll learn about what December held for us. But in Glenwood Springs, November's occupancy rates did show a slight downturn from the year prior, but just less than 1%. That doesn't really tell us how much Glenwood is dependent on snow levels up in Aspen. I did speak with Lisa Langer. She handles tourism promotion for Glenwood Springs. She said she's had conversations with hotel owners in Glenwood who say that reservations are up through the holidays and that January is looking strong.
And what does it look like around the West? Aspen isn't the only resort community with less snow than expected right now.
Yeah, so some studies are saying that resorts throughout the West are doing okay. November's occupancy rate was up kind of throughout the West, and the winter on the whole looks pretty good. Resorts are booked out more fully for the entire winter season than they were last year. There's one exception, though. December is not expected to be as busy as it was last year. And a busy December is what can make or break a resort season. So we'll definitely know more in January when the December numbers come out.
All right. We'll look for those in early 2018. Thank you, Wyatt.
You're welcome.
Dan Young is a painter and Colorado native. He's the featured artist in the 25th annual Coors Western Art Exhibit in Denver. Claire, you went to his home studio.
Yes, I did. He's a longtime resident of Silt, so I made the trek down I-70, and he shared with me his passion for art and nature, and you can literally see it in his home studio. There are just thousands upon thousands of paintings in there. Antlers and landscapes of western Colorado cover the walls. A mound of paintbrushes, each varying in size, are spread across the countertop. Behind the large easel with monitors, on either side are windows of views into what Dan Young sees each day. Photo albums fill the shelves, and above them are stacks on stacks of paintings. Young estimates he has between 3,000 and 4,000 paintings in here.
I'd love to tell you they were all great paintings, but there's some failures in the stacks too. But the neat thing about having the inventory like this, I can flip back through paintings and there'll be something in that painting that I go, oh, that's interesting.
Young is a Colorado native. He grew up with the mountains and playing in nearby river valleys. He says he paints what he knows, and that's nature.
My field work is my foundation. That's my starting point.
Before deciding to commit to his craft full time, he worked as a commercial illustrator for a department store in Texas, designing dishes and bedspreads.
When I was illustrating, I would get basically a product and I would do a representation of that product as accurately as I could. Well, when I started painting, I started going outside and basically painting every leaf on the tree. And I figured out pretty quick that this wasn't going to work.
Now he says it's all about divvying up time between the outdoors, where his source material awaits, and putting the pieces together in his studio. Young grew up in Glenwood Springs and says there isn't a road within 100 miles he hasn't worked from.
When I'm outside painting, I'm observing and I'm trying to translate it. I'm trying to see a color, mix a color, and make it into a painting. All this information that's out in front of me, I'm trying to sift it down to the essentials and then put it on a panel. So it becomes very intense, if you will. I mean, a day of painting, I come home and you think I had just been to the Olympics.
In the winter, Young says plein air painting becomes a race against the setting sun.
The lighting is better because the sun's a lot lower, so you get dramatic light all day long, which is wonderful. That I've learned in the winter, I paint a lot faster. When it's cold and your fingers hurt, you learn to do that a lot quicker. Some of the best paintings I do are those that I did in an hour because I didn't have enough time to put too much information in. So I grabbed the essence of it.
Young's work will also be exhibited at the Ancor Logos Gallery's upcoming exhibition, Winter in the West, beginning on January 10th.
That's all for Mountain Edition this week. I'm Kristen Kay.
And I'm Claire Woodcock. You can find more news from the Roaring Fork Valley and from all around the world on our website, aspenpublicradio.org.
Tune into Valley Roundup tomorrow at 3:30. This week, reporter Wyatt Orme will host a discussion about water in the Roaring Fork Valley, always a hot issue, with a panel of local reporters.
They'll have a lot to wade through. Thanks for listening. Mountain Edition is a production of Aspen Public Radio News.